The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition for Time Magazine, from which I will read, is the same as last week's. It's dated March 29/April 5, 2021. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red. It says, "We are not silent," as the headline, "Confronting America's legacy of anti-Asian violence." And that is above the superimposed white lettering over the cover photo, which is artwork of an Asian woman with long black hair, dark eyes, very red lips, different colors of tan in her facial and neck skin. She is surrounded by brilliantly colored blooms of flowers, and there's a pale purple or lavender background. This work, this cover art, was done by Amanda Fengbodipakaya, an artist based in Brooklyn. She says, "I still believe in our city." Beginning then with the first article, entitled "Silent No More: A Tragedy in Atlanta and America's Long History of Violence Against Asians," by Katie Lang. There's a photo here. It's a double-page insert photo. In the dark, except it's not totally dark because there are streetlights in the background. So trees are visible in the foreground, the green leaves of trees. Nevertheless, the background is black as night. The caption reads, "A March 4 candlelit memorial in Fountain Valley, California, pays tribute to victims of anti-Asian hate crimes amid the pandemic." And there are many, perhaps hundreds, at least dozens of luminaria spread across this parkway, and I don't know if it is a park, but they're shining, glowing in the dark. It was heartbreaking and horrifying, but to many it was not a surprise. The news that 8 people, 6 of them Asian American women, were killed at businesses in the Atlanta area March 16 came after a year of intense anti-Asian racism in the U.S. On the platforms where news arrives first and quickly attaches to feelings, emotions were already raw. This mass shooter was targeting Asian women and their businesses. This is not an isolated incident. There have been 500-plus hate crimes targeted at Asian people this year alone, social media specialist Mark Kim wrote on Twitter. This Atlanta tragedy lies at an intersection of race, gender, class, and the legacy of America's history of colonization and violence in Asia, journalist Elise Hu said on the site. "I do not have the words. I am just despondent. Protect Asian women. Solidarity with sex workers. Stop Asian hate." And as posts went viral with comments affirming their calls for change, the news kept coming. Atlanta shooting suspect told investigators that killings of Asian women were not racially motivated, police say, said a Washington Post news alert. A quote from a Daily Beast story had described the alleged shooter, who was charged March 17 with 8 counts of murder, as the son of a pastor who was very innocent-seeming. Meanwhile, the victims remained nameless. Later in the day, 4 were identified. Delana Ashley Yon, 33. Paul Andre Michaels, 54. Zhaoji Yan, 49. And Dao Yu Feng, 44. Additionally, LCSR Hernandez Ortiz, 30, was injured in the attack. Officials from the Atlantic Police Department are not naming the other victims until their families are notified. By the time their names were made public, the suspect would already be accounted for by a member of the Cherokee County Sheriff's Office, who, in a video that was widely circulated, said, "Yesterday was a really bad day for him, and this is what he did." In the dissonance was confirmation of what many Asian Americans already knew. The violence that has long targeted their community is rarely seen for what it is. Since the start of the pandemic last spring, Asian Americans have faced racist violence at a much higher rate than in previous years. Stop AAPI Hate, a reporting database created at the beginning of the pandemic as a response to the increase in racial violence, received 3,795 reports of anti-Asian discrimination between March 19, 2020 and February 28, 2021. Women reported hate incidents at 2.3 times the rate of men. After his capture, the police noted that the shooter said he was seeking to address a sexual addiction and was not racially motivated. But for Asian women, racism and misogyny are deeply intertwined. A 2018 report from the American Psychological Association outlined the ways in which Asian American women are exoticized and objectified in media and popular culture, depicted as faceless, quiet, and invisible, or as sexual objects. The survey said these stereotypes contribute to experiences of marginalization, invisibility, and oppression for Asian American women. March 16, America saw that reality manifest in the most brutal way. From the time the first wave of Chinese immigrants arrived as laborers in the U.S. in the 1850s, Asian Americans have always been subject to racist violence. As a source of cheap labor to build railroads, Asian immigrants came to be seen as threats to white jobs and scapegoated as dirty and disease-ridden. The Yellow Peril ultimately led to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. The first time the U.S. had ever barred a specific ethnic group from the country. The brutality runs through more than 2 centuries of U.S. history, from the incarceration camps of World War II, when over 100,000 Japanese Americans were rounded up and imprisoned because of xenophobic fears, to the 1982 murder of Vincent Chin, who died after being beaten by white men in a racially motivated attack in Detroit. Yet while racial violence has been an undeniable part of the history of Asian Americans in the U.S., the pervasive model minority myth has helped to obscure it. That false idea, constructed during the civil rights era to stymie racial justice movements, suggests that Asian Americans are more successful than other ethnic minorities because of hard work, education, and inherently law-abiding natures. Racial justice educator Bianca Mabute-Louis emphasizes the connection between this damaging stereotype and the violence we have seen on the news, videos featuring Asian American elders shoved to the ground. This contributes to erasing the very real interpersonal violence that we see happening in these videos and that Asian Americans experience from the day to day, things that do not get reported and things that do not get filmed, she says. Because the myth suggests upward mobility, it creates a fallacy that Asian Americans do not experience struggle or racial discrimination. In reality, the community is America's most economically divided. A 2018 study by the Pew Research Center found that Asian Americans experience the largest income inequality gap as an ethnic and racial group in the U.S. The current surge in anti-Asian hate crimes was exacerbated by the xenophobic rhetoric of former President Donald Trump, who's continued to refer to COVID-19 as the China virus, blaming the country for the pandemic. Trump's choice of words followed a long American history of using diseases to justify anti-Asian xenophobia, one that has helped to shape perception of Asian Americans as perpetual foreigners. There is a clear correlation between President Trump's incendiary comments, his insistence on using the term Chinese virus, and the subsequent hate speech spread on social media, and the hate violence directed toward us, says Russell Jung, a co-founder of Stop AAPI Hate and a professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University. Anti-Asian racism also surged during the pandemic in Britain and Australia, with incidents of discrimination and xenophobia reported last summer by Human Rights Watch in Italy, Russia, and Brazil. The news from Atlanta landed hard in Asian communities already feeling extraordinarily vulnerable. We are all feeling a collective trauma at the moment, says May Ann Peterson, co-founder of BESEA.N, Britain's East and Southeast Asian Network. We know that this is not just a problem for North America. President Joe Biden has sought to undo the damage wrought by his predecessor. Shortly after taking office in January, he signed an executive order denouncing anti-Asian discrimination. During a March 11 speech on the anniversary of the COVID-19 pandemic, he said, "Hate crimes against Asian Americans are un-American, and they must stop." 5 days later, the gunman started shooting. The president was not alone. One day before the shootings, Dr. Michelle Au, a state senator of East Asian descent in Georgia, spoke out on the imminent danger faced by the Asian community during the pandemic. "Asian Americans are part of our country's plurality," she said. "Recognize that we need help. We need protection. And we need people in power to stand up for us against hate." What form that protection takes has been part of a heated debate among Asian Americans, particularly in the wake of a national reckoning over systemic racism and police brutality after the killing of George Floyd in May. During a recent surge in physical violence ahead of Lunar New Year, actors Daniel Dae Kim and Daniel Wu shared on Twitter a video of a 91-year-old man being pushed down in Oakland, California, Chinatown. They offered a $25,000 reward to anyone who could provide information about the attacker, who had also pushed down a 60-year-old man, as well as a 55-year-old woman who was left unconscious from the attack. Kim's tweet brought up mixed feelings within the AAPI community. His attempt to raise awareness tapped into a long-time grievance of many Asian Americans that violence against them has often been downplayed or ignored. At the same time, the offer of a reward, particularly in a situation where the alleged attacker was a black man, underscored the difficulty of tackling anti-Asian violence without relying on law enforcement institutions that have historically targeted black and brown communities. The Oakland police charged 28-year-old Yahya Muslim with assault, battery, and elder abuse. This looks a lot like a bounty on a black person funded by Asian American celebrities, wrote writer and consultant Kim Tran. I have major doubts. Rather than turning to additional policing, community leaders have stressed the importance of grassroots organizing at this time, as well as the need for cross-community solidarity. We know that this is an issue that affects all our communities, and we have to break the cycle of violence, says Jung, the Stop AAPI Hate co-founder. Additional policing does not pose a threat just to black and brown communities. People of Asian descent have also suffered disproportionately at the hands of law enforcement. In the aftermath of the March 16 killings, many were reminded of the 2017 death of Yang Song, a massage parlor worker who fell to her death while trying to escape a police raid in Flushing, Queens. "Don't tell me increased police presence will save us," tweeted writer Mia Sato. For activists, stories like Song's are a reminder of the need to build solidarity across racial, economic, and social lines. Asians with power and visibility should be appalled that white men are targeting our most vulnerable groups, poor immigrant women, writer and activist Rosalind Tolusson said on Twitter. Protecting and advocating for Asian sex workers should be the founding pillars of any movement for racial justice in Asian communities. Details of the Atlanta crimes are still being gathered, but at ground level, the impact was immediate. "We are closed today because everybody's afraid," Grace Wang, manager of a local Atlanta spa, says. "All employees are worried to come to work, and customers too. And we decided to close until we find out what happened." There are no quick solutions to racial violence. What Biden calls un-American is, after all, deeply rooted in American history. Ending anti-Asian racism in the U.S. means confronting centuries of discrimination, violence, and oppression, and recognizing how it manifests in the present day. As Au noted in her statements this week, "This is a new chapter in a very old story. In order to write a new story, we have to acknowledge the ugly past that brought us here." Again, this article was written by Cady, C-A-D-Y, Lang, L-A-N-G, with additional reporting by Sue Yin Haynes, London, and Paulina Cachero, Andrew R. Chow, Leslie Dickstein, Kat Moon, Simone Shaw, and Francesca Triani, New York. There are some additional graphics. It's like a timetable here. And it's called A History of Hate. This appears on the bottom portion of two pages of this article. Beginning in 1871, as Chinese migrants begin arriving on the West Coast, xenophobia runs rampant. In 1871, a mob of white rioters descends on Los Angeles Chinatown, shooting and hanging 18 men and boys. 1882, President Chester Arthur signs the Chinese Exclusion Act, halting legal Chinese immigration until 1943. 1885, white miners in Wyoming massacre 28 Chinese co-workers, blaming them for poor working conditions. 1942, and this is accompanied by a tiny inset photograph of a little girl. She's standing in front of a microphone. Behind her is a man dressed in a suit, and he's playing what I would describe as a recorder, but perhaps it is not a recorder. It has that same shape and size, and they're standing, or she's standing, and he's seated in front of a U.S. flag. She's wearing what appears in this black and white photo to be a lovely little white frock. 1942, some 120,000 people of Japanese descent are rounded up and sent to incarceration camps, where many are held for more than 3 years. 1981, now this is also accompanied by a tiny inset black and white photo that looks like members of the Klan racing around a fire in a boat. 1981, with anti-Asian racism spiking after the Vietnam War, the Ku Klux Klan sets fire to Vietnamese refugees' houses and boats in Texas. 1982, Vincent Chin, 28, a Chinese American, is murdered in Detroit by two white auto workers who assume he's Japanese and blame him for the auto industry's decline. 1992, Korean businesses in Los Angeles are looted and destroyed during protests and riots following the police beating of Rodney King. 2001, the Sikh Coalition documents more than 300 cases of violence and discrimination against Sikh Americans in the first month after the September 11 attacks. 2020, reports of anti-Asian American violence skyrocket during the COVID-19 pandemic. In Texas, a family of three is stabbed by a man who thought they were Chinese and infecting people with the coronavirus. And the last inset, 2021. And it shows a tiny inset photo in black and white. It's very shadowy, but there's one person on either end of a gurney with a body covered in a black cloth being wheeled out of a building. A white man opens fire, 2021, at three spas around Atlanta, killing eight people, including six women of Asian descent. Essay, Waiting to Be Important, by Lucy Feldman, and this is shorter, I should say, than the previous article. I didn't go to work on the morning of March 17, meaning I did not get up, brush my teeth, and place myself at my desk in the living room. I stayed in bed, made a cave out of the covers, and watched the text messages roll in. Thinking of you, sending love, no need to respond. It had been a strange and terrible night. I had watched an uplifting talk by a writer and friend, a survivor of sexual assault, and a proud Asian American activist. I had added a few entries to the list she had recently encouraged me to make, gathering moments when my biracial Asian identity has been used to make me feel different or small. Just a few days before, we had laughed about my first item. At the sushi go-round in middle school, I wrote, when I had to pretend I would only eat seaweed salad on a dare because my friends thought it was gross. After the virtual event, I sent her a text congratulating her on yet another heartwarming talk. She wrote back, "What's happening with the shooting at the spas?" I searched for the news, found it. Eight people, mostly Asian women, shot and killed in Georgia. Immediately, I pictured the stunned and grief-stricken faces of their loved ones, their world shattered by an unwelcome phone call in the night. Then I recalled the video image of an elderly man shoved to the ground, the gash on a woman's forehead from an attack. An activist on the news, head bowed and gathering the strength. A neighbor in my own building just over a year ago. seeing my mother with a suitcase and saying with disgust to the woman I love most in the world, I hope you didn't just come from China. This is the movie that does not end. The ball of snow growing bigger as it rolls down the hill. The overwhelming sense of being other, less than, overlooked, deserving of this kind of hate. I will speak only for myself. For so long I've been the one to defer to the ideas, expertise, importance of others. At work I've let them tell me what I'm ready for, what value I can bring. In life I listen first, speak later. I do the work of caretaker and advocate. I empathize. This is my role and I play it well. I will lift you up and affirm you on both your darkest and proudest days, but also the smaller ones in between. I will notice when you seem a little sad or a little insecure, and I'll point you toward the right thing in your life story or a piece of history that will make you feel whole. I'll give you my energy and my time and my heart, and I will make things happen for you. These are the qualities the world has asked me to master. I'd like something in return. You're not supposed to write about big feelings while you're having them. You're supposed to wait until you have enough distance to be objective, to sort out the important details from the ones that will fade with meaning over time. But I realize that's the problem. I am always waiting my turn to be important. If I may, we are always waiting our turn to be important. In a morning news meeting for this magazine a few years ago, I stood nervously to the side of the table where the important editors would sit each morning, the rest of us listening closely for the moment when we could interject our voices with an idea or an update. The news of the day turned to detention at the U.S.-Mexico border, and someone important suggested we look for descendants of Japanese Americans who'd been sent to incarceration camps during World War II. My chest tightened as images shot through my mind. The intricate wooden end table, constructed one twig at a time at Minidoka by my great-grandfather, on display at my great-uncle's house. My mother's cackle as she retold a family story about a woman she knew, a chrysanthemum gardener being sent to Tule Lake, the camp for the troublemakers. The halls of the Capitol, where I accepted a congressional gold medal on behalf of my grandfather, long gone by the time the Nisei soldiers received this recognition. As we filed out of the meeting, I tapped the shoulder of my colleague tasked with finding a writer who could speak from a personal perspective. My family was interned, I said. He didn't even slow his step. We're looking for a big name. This time the conversation was different. I finally pulled myself out of bed, signed on to a meeting without brushing my teeth, hiding the T-shirt I'd slept in under a sweater. I told them what I wanted, a piece that says the thing I would want to read, a piece that tells me, as an Asian American person who's deferred and cared and tried so hard to help, that I'm worthy of the same, that we are worthy, you are worthy. The brief, sports, March Madness tips off in the Supreme Court by Sean Gregory. After COVID-19 felled last year's March Madness, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, NCAA, men's basketball tournament is unfolding amid a pandemic that's killed more than 535,000 Americans. As many college teams have struggled to contain the coronavirus all season, commercialism and economic injustice loom large. Players will continue to suit up in service of an event that's worth north of $800 million annually to the NCAA. Despite the lucrative nature of the tournament, which features millionaire coaches screaming on the sidelines and the health risk borne by the players who fuel the events, the athletes who hit the bracket-busting buzzer beaters still won't see their commensurate share of March Madness's riches. On March 11, Michigan State University even announced its men's basketball team would now be known throughout its home arena as MSU Spartans, presented by Rocket Mortgage. But NCAA rules disallow players from directly profiting from the new advertising deal. If there was ever an ideal time for player advocates to make a high-profile argument, say, in the highest court in the land, to reform the business model of college sports once and for all, you can't do much better than right now. On March 31, the Supreme Court will indeed hear oral arguments in what is sure to be a landmark case, NCAA v. Alston, A-L-S-T-O-N, in which a district court ruled and an appellate court upheld that the NCAA cannot limit education-related benefits for college athletes. The NCAA and 11 of its top conferences worried that the ruling was a slippery slope toward a true open labor market for players, appealed the case to the Supreme Court, which will make its first antitrust ruling on college sports in 37 years. The movement to fairly pay players, most of whom in the high-revenue sports of basketball and football are black, has reached state legislators, which have passed laws allowing athletes to profit from their name, image, and likeness. Congress, where several college sports bills have been introduced, and now the Supreme Court. March 10, the Department of Justice filed an amicus brief on behalf of players. With so many external pressures on the NCAA, it seems inevitable that we will have the most meaningful change in college sports in many of our lifetimes, says Gabe Feldman, director of the Tulane Sports Law Program. In its own Supreme Court brief, the NCAA cites the last Supreme Court antitrust ruling on college sports, the 1984 NCAA v. Board of Regents of the University of Oklahoma case, which said that conferences could negotiate their own TV rights deals, but the NCAA needs ample latitude to set policies like pay restrictions to play its critical role in the maintenance of a revered tradition of amateurism in college sports. The most telling brief in the case, however, may have been filed by six former NCAA executives, now eschewing a principle they were once paid to uphold. One of these former senior NCAA leaders, then Executive Vice President Mark Lewis, testified in 2014 for the NCAA at another class action trial. Of amateurism, Lewis said then, "At its heart, it is what college sports is." His perspective, however, has evolved. Lewis remembers meeting, along with NCAA President Mark Emmert, two football players during a trip to the University of Georgia. One could not afford a brake job on his car. Another struggled to buy food for his daughter. According to Lewis and the other former NCAA executives, the organization has shifted its focus from incorporating sports into the educational experience to a more commercial endeavor. The number one objective has been to generate money, Lewis tells Time. If that's changed, the fairness of how you treat a college student athlete has to change with it. $8.8 billion, the value of March Madness television and multimedia broadcast rights covering 2025 to 2032. That's $8.8 billion. 60%, the share of Americans who support the right of college athletes to profit from image and likeness endorsement money. $13 billion. Estimated loss of employee productivity during March Madness, that's $13 billion. The sources for the above information, Seton Hall Sports Poll, Challenger, Gray, and Christmas. COVID questions. This is a brief column. We are trying to make living through the pandemic a little easier with expert-backed answers to your toughest coronavirus-related dilemmas. Josh asks, I am 23 years old and split time at home and out of state for work. While I was out of state, my entire family got vaccinated and at this point have gotten both doses. That leaves me as the only one not vaccinated. How concerned should I be about them transmitting the virus to me? Time says, researchers are growing confident that vaccination lowers someone's chances of infecting others, although they don't know by how much. With the caveat that nothing in life is 100% guaranteed, you probably do not need to worry about catching the virus from your family, says Dr. Philip Landrigan, an epidemiologist at Boston College. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says fully vaccinated people can now safely gather unmasked at home with a small group of other vaccinated people, and can visit unmasked with a limited number of unvaccinated people, assuming none has risk factors for severe disease. To be cautious, you and your relatives could wear masks around the house until you are also vaccinated, but if you are healthy overall, you are probably not at high risk. Under the heading Health, Vaccine Science, here's another short column. Former Time editor Walter Isaacson spoke with Alice Park about his new book, The Codebreaker, and the research behind vaccines as part of Time 100 Talks. Here is an excerpt. Do you think genetics will lead the way out of this pandemic? Answer. Absolutely. Already we've seen how RNA vaccines are the vaccines that work the best, and it shows that molecules are the new microchip. We get to program them. Just like kids learned digital code, they're now going to also have to learn the code of life. And likewise, genetic coding will be able to make great detection technologies. Question, and how do you think mRNA will change the way we tackle infectious diseases in the future? The coronavirus vaccines and CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R, technology allow for gene editing. Those making use of RNA are transformative because you can reprogram them easily. Even as these new variants of the coronavirus come along, it is possible to reprogram in a matter of days exactly which part of the spike protein you are targeting. The good thing about gene editing and about genetic vaccines is they can be very personalized, and they're as easy to code and recode as a piece of software. Here's a small photograph of the book, The Codebreaker, by Walter Isaacson. That is, it's the book's cover. It doesn't indicate how thick it is. This is the Risk Report, Germany's Increasingly Shaky Political Future, by Ian Bremmer. On September 26, Germany's year of political change will culminate with the election of a new chancellor, an event that will close the remarkable 16-year tenure of Angela Merkel. For Merkel's Christian Democratic Union, CDU, the election year is off to a rough start. Early March saw the first two of six regional elections in 2021. CDU candidates won less than one quarter of the vote in the wealthy southwestern state of Baden-Württemberg and less than one-third in neighboring Rhineland-Palatinate. The results were the worst since the end of World War II for the party in each state. That outcome might well upend the race for Germany's next leader. Later this spring, 1,001 party delegates will vote on whether Armin Laschet, Merkel's chosen successor, or Markus Söder, head of its smaller Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union, CSU, will be the powerful coalition's joint candidate for chancellor. If delegates choose unwisely, they risk a September national vote that yields a new coalition government composed of the center-left SPD, the increasingly popular Green Party, and the fiscally conservative Free Democratic Party, FDP, with the CDU-CSU coalition locked out in the cold. The CDU is vulnerable. Laschet is likable but not a charismatic or forceful candidate, and he has low poll numbers. Yet the party has deeper problems. Merkel's government now faces a third wave of COVID-19 at a time when public frustration with tight lockdowns remains high, and both vaccines and economic help are slow in coming. Add political scandal. Revelations that two lawmakers, one CDU and one CSU, had earned hundreds of thousands of euros last year in business deals involving personal protective equipment have made headlines. Post-Merkel Germany looks increasingly up for grabs. That is important news for anyone who's appreciated the Chancellor's formidable leadership. Merkel's political skills and steady hand have been critical for Europe. Her "we can do this" response to the migrant crisis of 2015-16 won her bitter criticism from many quarters. In response to the pandemic, Merkel swept aside traditional German resistance to common European debt and won support for a 750 billion euro EU fund to boost Europe-wide recovery and growth. She led the way toward a long-sought EU investment deal with China. She pushed to make EU climate policy more ambitious. She persuaded the resistant governments of Poland and Hungary to accept rule-of-law provisions in EU budget rules. What does Merkel's exit mean for Europe? Certainly, Germany will remain fully committed to the EU project. If the CDU-CSU coalition cannot form the next government, a center-left-led coalition will continue support for European integration. But if that coalition involves the FDP, Germany's government may again become less willing to spend whatever it takes to manage the next EU crisis. A turn back toward belt tightening might well stall Europe's pandemic recovery. Merkel's departure will make France's Emmanuel Macron Europe's most important leader. That means less concern for the health of EU relations with the U.S., greater skepticism of the value of NATO, a more confrontational attitude toward Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and a more interventionist approach to the Middle East and North Africa. In short, it means a significant change in European leadership on the EU's role in the world. How that plays out for the EU remains to be seen, but there's nothing good about so much political uncertainty inside Europe's most powerful country. This is The View. It looks like a cartoon. A year at home by the numbers. It was a year ago that the COVID-19 pandemic seized control of our lives. While essential workers remained on the job, the rest of America, confined to quarters, tried to come to terms with a life on pause, working, learning, and passing the time almost entirely from home meant changes in habits, health, relationships, and plans for the future. Numbers don't tell the whole story, of course, but these at least describe the contours of the lives we lived, by Emily Barone. Now, there are various little rectangles here containing information. And they're accompanied by little cartoonish caricatures of people and things. And there are categories: time, well-being, relationships, home, shopping. People pass time on puzzles. Purchases tripled in 2020, according to distributor Puzzle Warehouse. This is under the time category, as will be the following. Air travel dropped from 4.5 billion passengers worldwide in 2019 to 1.8 billion in 2020. 77% of kids ages 5 to 12 spent at least 4 hours a day on devices in August versus 35% pre-pandemic, and 8% topped 9 hours. In March 2020, the average adult spent 13.5 hours per day looking at screens, up 3 hours and 20 minutes from 2019. Americans spent more time baking. Sales of yeast quadrupled in March 2020 and nearly doubled for all of 2020. The average household watched 11 hours of streaming video on demand in July, nearly double from a year earlier. Public school buildings closed to all 50.7 million K through 12 students last March. Today, one in five of those kids does virtual-only school. E-book and audiobook checkouts via the public library app Libby are up 51% and 23%, respectively, since last March. The next category will be well-being. Worker burnout. Among U.S. employees at large, companies jumped from 42% pre-pandemic to 72% by August. While about 20% of U.S. adults are getting less sleep during the pandemic, some 10% are getting more sleep. In June, almost 7% of services listed on U.S. insurance claims related to telehealth, compared with just 0.16% in June 2019. While one in six health clubs and gyms closed in 2020, Peloton's quarterly revenue ending June 30 jumped 172%. Peloton, I believe, is a home gymnastics equipment provider. 78% of Americans delayed at least one medical service in the 3 months leading up to February 2021. From May to August, 13% of households spent money on vacations, down from 30% in the same 2019 period. Relationships is the next category. 39% of couples who'd planned a 2020 wedding pushed or canceled the reception. 15% postponed the wedding. Sex life quality declined last spring for 44% of adults, according to one online survey. 14% reported an improvement. 269,896 pets were adopted from rescue groups in 2020, 36,000 more animals than in 2019. Initial data from five states show that divorce rates have declined during the pandemic by about 22%. Next category, home. After plummeting last spring, home sales soared in the second half of the year to levels not seen since 2006. Residential electricity use in April through July was 10% higher than normal, costing households an extra $6 billion. In January, the savings rate was 20.5%, up from 7.6% a year earlier, yet 2 in 5 adults have had to tap into savings or borrow money. Vehicles traveled 430 billion fewer miles on U.S. roads in 2020, a drop of about 13% from 2019. Home Depot sales jumped 21% in 2020, while leads for remodeling pros on Houzz.com were up 60% last summer from 2019. The next and final category, shopping. 40% of consumers tried home delivery apps or curbside pickup for the first time during the pandemic. A toilet paper frenzy doubled sales last March. More recently, toilet paper sales have sunk below pre-pandemic levels. The online marketplace Etsy sold 53 million face masks from April to September. I think I bought a couple of those. Hand sanitizer purchases increased 261% in March 2020 and were up 624% for all of 2020. Food orders through delivery service DoorDash hit 816 million in 2020, more than tripling the company's 2019 orders. Online sales of pajamas grew 143% from March 2020 to April 2020, while those for pants and bras fell 13% and 12%. This article may actually be somewhat abridged due to time constraints. The View Essays, Society, How to Actually Help an Overwhelmed Caregiver, by Kate Washington, who's the author of Already Toast, Caring and Burnout in America. My husband had been in the hospital critically ill for weeks when I broke down in tears one day during a workout. Concerned gym buddies consoled me, and then someone said, "You've got to stay positive." "Do I, though?" I wanted to ask. I was urged to stay positive a lot during the years I was a caregiver for my husband, Brad, through two kinds of lymphoma and a stem cell transplant that nearly killed him. The advice was always well meant, and I always forced a smile, but inside resentment flared. I left mad, even though I'd gone to the gym to keep up with my self-care. Following that other advice often given to caregivers, you have to take care of yourself. I bristled at that, too. Self-care added more items to my ever-growing to-do list. Other variations on the stay positive theme touched a raw nerve. "You've got this," led me to wonder if I had a handle on anything. And at stay strong, I wanted to collapse into a heap, preferably while wearing my softest pajamas. One day, as Brad lay unconscious in his hospital bed, the oncologist told me his odds of survival were about 10%. At that point, staying upright rather than taking to my bed felt like a victory. It seemed inconceivable that I might become much less stay positive. American culture exerts enormous pressure toward positivity, expressed most famously by Norman Vincent Peale's 1950s bestseller, The Power of Positive Thinking. Recent years have seen a backlash from Barbara Ehrenreich's incisive Bright-Sided to the growing recognition of toxic positivity, the insistence on an upbeat attitude, which can invalidate a person's experience, leading to guilt, anger, and increased stress. So what does help when a friend or family member's in the thick of caregiving or any crisis? First, offer space for the full range of their emotions on their terms. There's immense power in a simple text telling a friend you're there for them, particularly if you add this magic phrase at the end, "No need to respond." When I was overwhelmed, keeping up with communications was tough, and I appreciated friends who explicitly took the pressure off. I knew they saw and could handle my real experience, often harried, sometimes far from positive. When it comes to practical assistance, try to offer specific help that the caregiver does not have to ask for. However kindly meant, "What can I do?" puts the onus back on your overwhelmed friend to come up with a suitable task, increasing their mental load. I still tear up thinking of the matter-of-fact generosity extended by the parents of our then 6-year-old's best friend. They made a standing offer to take our daughter every Sunday, and for almost a year, we dropped her off, weekly, no questions asked, for a fun day with their daughter and a needed break from the caregiving sandwich for me. Local friends texted when they were going to Target asking if they could pick up necessities. One friend has revived such aid during the pandemic, offering grocery shopping to reduce our household exposure since Brad's still immunocompromised. Smaller gestures are sustaining, too. An acquaintance knew we liked a particular bakery's bread and would drop a loaf on our porch occasionally, texting me afterward. These measures added up to something with greater impact than self-care, community care. Our individualist society is long overdue for broad systemic change in how we support care of all kinds. But informal community networks offer solace that peppy slogans cannot. On my hardest days, the actions of family, friends, and even a few strangers gave me hope, relief, and dare I say it, a genuine, not forced, feeling of positivity. Again, the author is Kate Washington, and she wrote, Already Toast, Caregiving and Burnout in America. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.